It was my ability to get into water and forget about the world. It was my ability to do something that nobody judged me for. And I think those were really important, and I'd love to share that back, and that was the reason for being a part of Lawyers.
Well, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of our podcast, Partners in Time. It's a pleasure to have you all back with us today. And today we're going to talk a little bit about sport. We're going to talk about good and sport for good and the whole topic of Lawyers and the amazing work that Lawyers has been doing for many, many years now, inspired by the original vision of Nelson Mandela to change the world for the better through the power of sport. And today I'm joined by two exceptional athletes and Lawyers ambassadors from very different sports, but with both in their own unique ways, absolutely amazing sporting career and achievements. We have Natalie Dutoit with us, a South African Olympic and Paralympic swimmer. And we have Anna Schaffelhuber with us, a German Paralympic pro downhill skier. And both of them obviously achieving amazing success in their career. Multi-medal winners, including in the Paralympic Games at various points. But we're going to come to that in a second. But first of all, thank you very much for joining us. I just want to talk to you quickly, see where you're dialing in from, and just say hello. So, Natalie, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm dialing in from South Africa, from actually a really little town called Cape Agulhas, which is the southernmost tip of Africa. But that's my history for the day.
Brilliant. No, that's a good start.
No, great. So, you know, enjoying working from here and, yeah, I guess enjoying working from home as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's do the time check. What time is it in South Africa at the moment? I mean, it must be really our time.
It is 6:22 in the evening. So we're about an hour ahead of you.
Yeah, hour ahead of us indeed. And where and how do you time check? Is it the oven clock? Is it your smartphone? Is it your smart device or indeed your watch?
I think it's all of them, really. Which one comes first? but yes, in this case, it is my computer. So it might be a minute or two behind, but pretty much up to speed.
And welcome to the Mechanical Watches podcast. Here we are. No, brilliant. And Anna, same to you. Hi, thank you for joining, and where are you joining us from?
Hi guys. I'm sitting in Germany at the moment. It's 5:15 p.m. So a little earlier than to Natalie. Yes, we have great weather. I have on my desk, when I look out the window, we have snow on the mountains. So maybe a little bit different, like at Natalie's place.
Right. So I've got to ask you, Anna, and I know this is sort of a bit of an impromptu question here, but you know, I'm struggling very much when I can see snow out of my window and I'm supposed to do anything else but be out in the snow enjoying it. I get really bad FOMO. Can you handle it?
Yeah, I try to. No, it's okay. You know, I moved to the mountains a few years ago. So, it's getting more and more usual. But all in all, if you have a weather like today, of course, I want to go outside and do anything. But, you know, the sun is going down. So I think it might be okay.
Yeah, it might be okay this time of day. But also the other thing that's bugging me is this is the perfect ski week this week, because we had fresh snow last weekend and then in perfect conditions. And I think it's sunny more or less all week in most of the Alps this week. So everyone who's got this week off is extremely lucky. And it's guaranteed by the time it comes around to our ski week, it will be full on rain and +9 degrees, as it always is. But yeah. This is the week. Anyone who's got a couple of days off and some skis or snowboard or something handy, just go now.
Yes.
Brilliant. Now, thanks for joining us. I want to start with you, Natalie. Just tell us a little bit about your story and how you got into swimming, and a little bit sort of your journey into sport and your career. Just give us a little bit of the background.
Wow, that's a long story.
It's a long story.
I'm not a spring chicken anymore, but I started swimming at the age of 6, and actually I was the youngest sister in my family, and my brother was a swimmer, and I was kind of the little girl that sat on the side of the pool while my brother was training. And I was actually petrified of water. And then a few days before I turned six, I said to my mom, I want to swim. And she asked the coach if, you know, she'd put me in the water and see if I'm, if I have any potential whatsoever. And I got into the water and I think I just took to it. You know, I just loved the sport. I, here in South Africa, when I was a little girl, we used to race once a month. We used to compete, in whatever swimming pool. And I think that was just the way of life and the way that life, you know, became part of, you know, who I am, what I am, how I am, and everything about me. But yes, took to swimming. And I guess I went on my first international tour when I was 12 to Crystal Palace in London. Mm. It was a junior tour. And first time ever overseas. My parents actually couldn't afford it, so we had someone put up some money, and then I actually raised some money by walking the streets and asking for donations.
Wow.
I was 14 when I made my first international team to the Commonwealth Games, and I actually missed my race there, so I was a bit of negative media, negative talk. And then yeah, had a motorbike accident in 2001 when I was 17 years old. Mm. And yeah, I think throughout, you know, your career in swimming, it takes a long time to qualify for the Olympics. It doesn't just happen within 4 years, especially at a young age. You've got to work really hard. And yeah, you know, managed to get to the Olympics when I was 24 and reached my dreams and went to the Paralympics as well. So it was a long career. But yeah, I just love the sport. And I think, you know, I gave everything to it. So I put my heart and soul, all my energy into it.
Yeah. And I guess you're one of the very few people that are both Olympic and Paralympic athletes. Right? That hasn't been done many times at all.
Yes, it's sometimes challenging to explain, but you know, in the Olympic side, I swam open water. So it's the 10-kilometer event.
Yeah, yeah. That
and then
scary.
In the disabled side, it's in the swimming pool, and there are no distance events for disabled. So those are the sprinting events. And then generally when I competed in the pool, it was able-bodied 800 meters and 1500 meters. So yeah. I covered from a 50 meter sprint all the way to the 10 kilometer.
Wow.
And ultimately I placed fourth in the world championships to qualify for the Olympic Games, because we had to be top 10 in the world, to qualify. So yeah, it was tough, and it was a goal that I'd set from when I was a young girl. So to be able to achieve it is, I think, you know, everything that I set my heart on.
Mm. Well, that's I mean, these I mean, I really don't know a lot about competitive swimming, but when I watch these open water swimming events in the Olympics, that always looks very sort of hands on and quite pushy. Yeah? How is that?
So yes, it is. It's the marathon of swimming, but it is a group of swimmers that all dive in together.
Yeah.
So you stand on like a moving platform, and it was, I had to be really careful, because when you stand up with one leg, it's easy to fall over, because it's just a floating platform. So I used to sit right till the last minute when the gun went off, dive into the water, and literally you can dive on top of one another.
Yeah.
So it is trying to get away from the elbows, the fists, and, you know, throughout the race, it's trying to find the strategy that works for you. For me, it was the inside line and the shortest route possible. And, you know, the girls tend to swim quite a brutal race from the word go. They don't like to speed up every lap. They tend to go out hard from the beginning, whereas the boys race a little differently. But yes, you know, in my perfect race, I was just in the right spot. I didn't get hit. I didn't get kicked. And what we do feed, because it's such a long race. And if it's really hot, we do take gels or, you know, some liquid out of a bottle. And ultimately, you know, you can feed when you want. So there's usually spots along the 2.5-kilometer route. But yes, it's a grueling race, because if you do get an elbow in the face, for example, by mistake, your goggles can come off and you can get water in your goggles. You know, so there's a lot that can happen. But yes, I guess your race is trying to make sure that those things don't happen and make sure that you are in the front by the last lap so that you can sprint towards the finish.
Yeah. And I think that I used to see like where the turning boys are and thing, you actually have people in sort of canoes, just sort of referees watching over proceedings there, because, you know, that gives you an indication how pushy that race actually is. It is a hard race.
Absolutely. So the referees are there to make it fair. Yeah. There's a lot that happens under the water, I guess, like in water polo, that referees can't see. And, you know, between the boys, there's usually four laps of 2.5 kilometers. Sometimes there's different lengths and different amounts of laps, but usually the four, and you've got to what we call spot between the boys. So you've got to look from one boy to the next. And sometimes the lines split. And the referees are really there just to make sure that, you know, you don't get hit or kicked on purpose, that because when you're swimming, you can actually stop one stroke if you swim too close to them. You know, you can stop, you can touch their arms so that they don't get into a rhythm. And sometimes those are the tactics that the, you know, that the swimmers do have. So it's just to try and make it as fair as possible. And it's sometimes tough for the swimmer because you don't really hear the whistle that easily. And if you get, you know, two yellow cards, then you're actually disqualified. If you get a red card, you're disqualified. So you've also got to be very aware while you're racing. And if there are waves, it can be really challenging.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, who's ever tried open water swimming can relate to that. Definitely, it's nothing like the old swimming pool. And talk us through your Olympic and World Championship accolades. I mean, you've amassed quite the medal collection.
So I was disabled when I was 17 years old. So I only really got to know about disabled sport at that time. Mm. And so I wasn't in it for very long. I really had to learn what, you know, the different categories and the different, you know, events, because I wasn't a sprinter. I had to start sprinting if I wanted to compete. And I was an individual medley swimmer, so I wanted to race in every event because I get really bored just sitting on the side and watching everybody. So, you know, from the minute I was disabled, I started competing as a disabled person. And I had to be classified, so I had a class, and I got to know my competitors. And within a few months after my accident, I actually went off to the Commonwealth Games, and that was my first competition. And with that competition, it was all the different disabilities actually swimming in one race, and it was the person who was closest to the world record or broke the world record that actually won the gold medal, because there was only one gold, one silver, and one bronze medal. So that was how I sort of was thrown into the disabled side of things.
Yeah.
We actually call that multi-disability. But I was fortunate to qualify for, I think it's three Paralympics, 2004, yes, three Paralympics. And, you know, to win about a medal in almost every race that I competed in, I think bar one race. So I think from that, you know, it was a great time for me to retire after the three Paralympics. And I managed to also qualify for the Olympic Games, and that was probably the pinnacle of my career. But yes, I've competed at Commonwealth Games, World Championships, Olympic Games, Paralympic Games, so all the top games. And, you know, all the stepping stones that we needed to qualify for the top competitions, those were, you know, those were along the way as well. So I raced a lot, and I served three different sort of calendars in a year. So I had to do the able-bodied events, I had to do the disabled events, and I had to do the open water events to get points and to qualify, et cetera. So, you know, it took up a lot of my time, and it took, you know, from studies to everything I had to put aside in order to train the 8 hours a day and be ready for all the competitions.
Yeah, amazing. And then you retired in 2012, right?
Yes, many years ago.
Seems like yesterday. And what have you been up to since?
Well, it's been a roller coaster. I think, you know, sport was everything. And I think even though you're prepared for leaving sport, I don't think you can ever really be prepared. You know, things fly at you from different angles, and what you thought you were going to do, you didn't do, and you didn't go into. So I fell into communications and social media, and just, I'm actually a digital marketer. So I just found the love for that, because the time and effort that I spent in the pool, I think it's the same in social media. It's always changing. It's always different. But if you put in the hours, you know, you can make that difference, and you can grow that brand. And I think that's really been, you know, what's important to me. You know, being an ambassador for Laureus as well, from, you know, just as I was disabled, 2003. So I've been there for many years, and, you know, being able to see The different communities and the way that sport has the ability to bring to people's lives and to change people's lives the way that it did in my life. And the lessons that it taught me. So, you know, motivational speaking, I do a little bit of that too. And serving on commissions, on sports commissions. And I think that's my role within sport. I didn't want to become a coach. So
yeah.
I think giving back the lessons that sport taught me is something that's fundamental to me. So yeah, that's kind of been my role the last few years.
Brilliant. Amazing. Same question then to Anna. Anna, even you obviously, you're also in water, albeit frozen. So let's have a little chat. Your story and your sports career and what's been happening ever since.
Well, so you have to know that's a big difference for myself. So I prefer the frozen water. I can go outside. It does not matter how cold it is. But a cold water and to go into it and swim, that's a leap. You have full respect. That's not my thing. So, how can I start? So, I learned skiing when I was 5 years old. So I have two brothers, an older and a younger one. And both of them wanted to learn skiing. And I have my disability since birth. So, and at this moment, of course, I wanted to go skiing too. But and then my dad read the newspaper, and there was an article that, it's possible to learn sit skiing, so to learn skiing with a monoski. So that was the point it was my first try. I went to Austria and learned skiing. So it was very early when I recognized for myself that when I'm on a sit ski, I can go wherever I want to, and it does not matter if I have a wheelchair or not. So I can reach every place where able person can go to So it was the first time on the sit ski, and really I love the sport, and I love the mix out of the speed and of the about feeling free. So. I learned skiing from a person, from Gerda, who was a Paralympian too, 7 years ago. And I met Gerda a few times, and she always wanted to try to take part in some competitions. But if I'm honest, in the first time I did not want to, because I knew I cannot train at home. So I have to leave the family, I have to go to the mountains. I knew my life, my whole life will change. And the first time I did not want this. And but I met Gerda, I think I was 13, I met her once again. And she asked me if I want to have a try. And if I'm honest, with 13, 14, it was the first time for myself when I said, might be good not to be so often at home and don't to go to school very often, all these things. And then I went to the first like a training camp. And that was very important for myself, because on the one hand, there were trainers who kept an eye on myself and decided if it makes sense or not. And of course, but for myself, it was very important because, I saw what is skiing in a competition, because it's completely different. Like, go free skiing and have a look for the nature and all these things. I was not that slow. So I saw, I'm not that slow. It was the first time when I got ambitious, and I thought, it was not that I said, okay, I want to go to the Olympic Games in a few years. It was, more like I wanted to do step by step. So the first time I want to take part in the Bavarian, games. And then I was the German national championships, and I was 15 or 16 when I took part in my first international competition. And yeah, and then I was a very young girl. I just turned 17 when I took part in my first Paralympic Games in Vancouver. And yeah, you know, it's always my whole career. It was step by step. And I remember when I was at my first games, I was on the start, and it was the first time when I recognized how fast things worked out. And I said, okay, I did not think about take part in the Paralympics, and hello, here I am. And in the next years after Vancouver, I took part in the Paralympic Games in Sochi and in Pyeongchang, so the last games. And I really had a great time. I really I loved my job. So I loved going to ski. I loved the training around this, and I think it's very similar to Natalie's story. So I gave all my heart to the sport, and I moved to the mountains. So left the family, left home, and but that was what I wanted to do. And but after a few years or several years, I think I was 25, 26. First time when I thought, okay, I had a great time, and I had a very intensive time. But for myself, it felt a little bit like I want to have some new challenges. You know, so I left home with the age of 13 years old, and then I was 26. I finished school, I finished my studies, beside the sport. So that was a point for myself where I said, okay, I had a great time, and I retired from the active sport. And I think it was similar to Natalie too. I did not want to become a trainer, because then I said, okay, I will be I won't be at home like before, but now I don't ski. I stand on the mountain, and and that's not what I wanted to do. So I founded a camp. It's called the Anna Schaffelhuber Camps. It's a camp for abled and disabled children. And and now I work as a teacher, and I have my camps, and I really love this job now.
Yeah, and they look amazing, man. I just want to mention quickly that obviously you did have a full clean sweep in Sochi. Huh? You won every single alpine skiing event at the Sochi Games in downhill. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
That's pretty amazing.
Yes, it was.
Has anyone done that before?
Sorry?
Has anybody else ever done that?
Honestly, yes. There was a Canadian girl, Lauren Wollstonecraft. She did it once, once again. So we are the two persons.
So you have to have a duo one day and have it out.
Yes. Might be.
For the goat title.
I had a really, really good good season in 2014. Yeah. So I trained in a team with men. And we had a great team, and I was very ambitious. My teammates were very ambitious, and my training in summer went very, very well. So I went into the season, and I knew after the first competitions, I knew it might be possible, but honestly, I did not think that I will win all the gold medals, because at the Paralympics, it's a different competition, like a World Cup, and everything has to be perfect. And but that it worked out, honestly, the first time when I counted the medals, really, it was on my way back home to Germany. Wow. And I think it took several months.
When the airline refused to take your cabin luggage on board due to weight. So what have you got in there? Yeah. Oh, 14 gold, 17 silvers.
Yeah, so even now it sounds strange. Yeah, but when I go to one of my rooms here, the medals are there, and I'm very happy about that. Mm. But yeah, cannot describe these feelings when I went
to
one
there.
That's
amazing. I saw in some pictures at least at one point we were ski equipment buddies. I saw an Atomic Redster G9 there. Was that your super G ski?
Yes. So in the end of my career, after Sochi, I changed the ski. So in the end, I raced with Atomic, and it might be my super G ski. Yeah.
Redster G9, very good ski. No advertising here, but long radius, a ski how we like.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yes. And I still have it here in my house.
Yeah. Do you remember, by the way, a sort of random question, do you remember the top speed you've ever done in a competition in your life?
Yeah, it was around 130 kilometers per hour.
Okay, you win. Jeez. I find anything sort of beyond 110, I find very unnerving. Especially when you then start turning at those speeds. I mean, that's the last thing I'd consider.
Yeah, you know, my pupils at the moment, when they ask me how fast is it, 130 kilometers per hour, I always say them, it feels like if you're on the motorway,
standard
with
motorway
your
speed,
parents, and just put your hand out the window, so it's very unclear in sight and all these things.
And I mean, I always wanted to ask, and again, that's a really stupid beginner's question, but is the ski that you race, is that actually stiffer than what I would buy in a shop as a civilian, even though it's got the same branding on, or is it essentially the same ski?
It's not the same ski. Yeah. So very often they sell a race ski, but it's not the same ski like you have or in the World Cup races.
Yeah.
It's similar, but slightly different.
It must be, because the way that my skis start to wobble when you go a certain speed, it looks very different when you watch people going down the drive. Their skis just seem to stick to the ice.
That's right. And honestly, but to ski with these skis beside a competition and only go just for fun, it's not a fun with these skis. So for just having fun with the skiing, I don't use the competition skis. Just take. We say tourist skis.
Yeah. Last question on that, if you don't mind me asking, where did you learn skiing? Where did you go as a 4-year-old to have your first go on the ski?
I went to Austria because where I grew up, you cannot go skiing. So I went to Austria. It's called Karnatal. It's close to Landeck. So, in Tyrol.
Very nice. Regensburg. See, I had lots of people from Regensburg in my army ski team because I was down in Brandenburg. I'm in the military ski team, very close to Rosenheim and Munich. And
that's where I live at the moment.
Are you there? Brilliant. See, so half my team were originally from Regensburg, so I know the area a little bit. There you are. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about Laureus. Natalie, question to you. I mean, obviously, you've been involved with Laureus. You've been also, I think, Laureus the sports person with a disability of the year, I think, in 2010, if I remember correctly. Tell us a little bit about what Laureus means to you and your experience sort of working with and supporting the organization.
Sure. I think firstly, listening all about skiing, I think that's absolutely crazy to go those speeds without four doors. But I think, you know, it really is just amazing how sport just, you know, can do something for an individual. And I think that is kind of where Laureus was really special to me. I managed to go off to, I think it was, where was it? Spain, Dubai. I can't even remember the cities, but, my first time being at the awards, and I'm going to start with the awards for a reason. And, you know, to see the top sports people within Laureus and to see, the amazing, I think, you know, the amazing award ceremony that raises all these funds and goes into these areas where, you know, kids are struggling, people are struggling, and different sports teaching different lessons. And, you know, Nelson Mandela is saying sport has the power to change the world, and the power that has. You know, those words were said at the awards, and seeing it happen in real life is truly, you know, it's amazing. Being part of some of the programs, you know, we go in and just be a part of the day. We do some, you know, events, raise some funds, raise awareness. And I think from that perspective, it is the very little that one can do as a sports person and give back. I haven't really thought about starting my own schools or anything like that, or organizations. But I think to focus on Laureus for me was important. And yeah, I think it's just, it just has that same language, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that was what it was. It was the fit. It was, you know, being a young girl and being involved in sport and what sport taught me. And I didn't grow up in the wealthiest of homes, and we struggled as well. So, you know, it was my backup. It was my ability to get into water and just swim and forget about the world. It was my ability to do something that nobody judged me for. And I think those were really important, and I'd love to share that back. And that was the reason for being a part of Laureus. Mm.
And from your perspective, why do you think it is that sport has such a transformative power when it comes to young people's lives from all sorts of different backgrounds? Why is it such a good agent for change, you think?
You know, there's I guess, a lot of science behind some of it as well. You know, all of us are very, very different. Some of us come from really tough backgrounds, poor backgrounds. And if I take, you know, myself and I take some of the projects, and you've got some of the kids that were part of programs that became leaders in the YES program, and have gone on to start their own organizations and teach younger kids. Sport just has the ability, and in my case, it was the ability to achieve something and feel like you're worth something. It has the ability to, you know, as I said, switch off and take out your frustrations, not on a person, but in sport and by achieving and, you know, just training hard. We see a lot of, you know, a lot of the programs focus on, you know, for example, Fight with Insight, it is, ultimately boxing, but it's not to take it out on the opponent.
Yeah.
So it actually teaches you to calm yourself. So there's different programs that work on different things and different challenges within the different areas that seem to be one of the biggest challenges or problems within that area. You know, and I think, you know, we talk about sport, and I mean, even for Anna, it was, you know, I wouldn't imagine being able to ski, let alone being able to ski as a disabled person. But the ability to ski, for me, it was the ability to get into water and still be able to swim. There's a lot of disabled, you know, people out there that get into sport and it allows them to live. You know, it's not always about the money that comes in, but it's about finding your purpose or finding something that you can do that makes you feel like a little bit of a human.
Mm.
And I find a lot of the projects, you know, it brings people together. It brings them, you know, to do some work, to play, to make friends, to break down stigma, to break down some of the cultural barriers and cultural challenges, specifically here in South Africa. You know, and, you know, I can share a story of swimming. Girls wear a swimming costume. And, you know, it's teaching boys that ultimately, you know, you can't just touch a girl in a costume. You know, you can't just be rude to her because she's wearing a costume, but ultimately at the end of the day, she's also human and you've got to treat her with respect. So I think those are a lot of the lessons that I've seen happen in front of my eyes. And for that reason, it's really special. And yeah, I guess I was just an example of, you know, the power of sport as well. And it's difficult to say specifically what sport did, because it's kind of made me who I am. And I think that's kind of what happens, is you get caught up in it and it makes you who you are. It is, you know, the drive, the passion. You don't know all of those while you're an athlete until you retire and you sit back and you think. And I think that's the precious part of it, is you don't always know what you're learning. You know, you're not sitting at a desk and learning something, but you're learning it as you're doing it.
Yeah, I want to touch on that a little bit, because that especially is that development and formative aspect of what sport does to young people, I think, is something that, you, Anna, really work on very directly with your Grenzenlos camps, which in English is Limitless, where I think you encourage young people from all different ability backgrounds to come together and find their own limits and also see what they can do and get that sort of reconfirmation through different sport and other based experiences. Tell us a little bit about that and what it does for young people at an age when they might be sort of finding out who they really are and they're still in this formative process, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very interesting age of the kids. So they are, I have two camps. One is from the age of 14 to 17, and one camp is from, 18 to 21. So both ages are very, interesting and spectacular because, so I recognized in the last years, especially when I talked with them, some partners from myself, that many kids at this age are not that self-confident. And they fear to apply to a job because they think, especially the kids with a disability, oh no, maybe I cannot apply there because I'm a disability and I don't know. They're not self-confident. And that was one of the points when I started to think about it and started to plan and organize the camps. And another point was, my whole life, especially in my childhood, there were a lot of camps where to that people could go with a disability, or there were camps with for people without a disability. And I always missed a camp for all people. So it doesn't matter of the color of their hairs or their skin or disability or anything like that. So that was a point when I started to do the camps. And we have three big points in the camps. One is the sport point, where the kids try a lot of sports. And like you said, they just have a look, where's my limit? And maybe I can do more than I think. Or maybe, okay, it does not work out like this. So maybe I have to change anything and then it is possible to do anything. I think that's the point Natalie said before. The people, with or without a disability, they just, get each other to know, they get in contact and they see, okay, maybe the first time I see a disabled kid, and it's like, oh, maybe he or she cannot do this or that. But after the week, they recognize, okay, everyone has a strength and everyone can motivate or inspire anyone else. So with the other two points of the camp, so it's media and where the kids make their own film and video and the personality. So we work with the personality and with the self-confidence, like I told in the beginning. So, and it was every time, honestly, I'm very, very excited when I go to the camps and when a new camp starts, because, I don't know the kids or the teenagers before I go there. And each group is completely different. And of course I can many hours about the camp and I can organize whatever I want to, but the group has to be open-minded and every time when I go home, I was very, very happy about the camp, when I see people live the values you want to get them to know. So it's one of my big big things I have in my heart and want to see. So I'm really looking forward for the next camps in this year. So this year we have more camps like before. So last year we had 3 camps a year. This year we have 5 camps. And it's, for me, it's perfect and wonderful to see to see this project growing.
Yeah, no, and it's amazing, as you said, you know, to not have the segregation of different abilities, but to have young people come together like that and experience things together, that is really what builds a lot of confidence and understanding. And I think, as you say, it's the big missing link often when we talk about different abilities and disability is the fact that even though, you know, that there might not be any prejudice or anything in any way, people might, you know, young people as well, if they've never been in touch with people of different abilities, that there might be a nervousness, there might be barriers, etc. And people just also being scared of maybe insulting somebody or doing the wrong thing. And I can relate to that in a sense, because my 2 older children actually spent a little bit of time in the English schooling system, which is, by comparison to the sort of continental European schooling systems, a very integrated, public school system where kids of very different levels of ability and learning support and all the rest of it all work together in the same classroom. And I think what it does is it really gives kids an understanding of all of the different levels of ability in their peer group from a very early age. So then they're not hesitant to get in touch. They're not hesitant to make contact. They're not hesitant to invite other kids to play, because they've seen it from basically the first day of nursery. Whereas I think if you have very separated and segregated schooling systems, then I think those barriers, they're bound to be there more, because it's just not, kids are just not used to it. And I think that you're bringing everybody together in this way is just amazing.
Yeah, so it becomes normal for the kids.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important point.
Mm. No, and let's also, Natalie, I want to touch on that. Obviously, you've had this entire sort of, you know, career also seen from both sides in South Africa. And, you know, obviously, I want to talk a little bit about the whole equality and inclusion topic as well, because I'm sure that, or I hope that progress has been made over the years when you look back in your career and your life. But where are there still areas where we really need to improve, where we need to work on, and what can be done, and what can everybody get involved with to really make those changes for the better still happen today?
Well, I think it's a very open question. When I was disabled in 2001 and competed in 2002 for my first time, there was, you know, as I spoke about multi-disability then, so I'm going to go with sport first. Mm. And ultimately, it was, you know, we were the showcase of the tournament because there was only 2 races for us. And I swam able-bodied as well there. But I think it was really interesting because you kind of felt like you were a showcase. And, you know, here in Africa, we've had our African championships where we actually raced 2 hours before all the able-bodied. Because we got different medals and you get, you know, many different things. So obviously there's at the highest level of sport, there's the two different bodies. There's the IOC and the IPC. And, you know, as an athlete, you are classified, etc. And I think from that perspective, if I look at the Commonwealth Games, going from the multi-disability events, there's 2 or 3 events and they've classed 2 or 3 classes together only, rather than just all the multi-disability together. It's been a big topic in sport for so many years. And I know now that, you know, there's a lot of research being done, a lot of questions being answered from different levels, different perspectives. I must admit that for me, it was tough trying to integrate into able-bodied sport because as the disabled events became part of the able-bodied events, it wasn't enough, you know, there wasn't enough races or, you know, it discriminates against some of the disabilities because they weren't fast enough, for example. And I think that's challenging, you know, from traveling and, you know, as a severely disabled person, you need a second to help you.
Yeah.
And that becomes an extra expense. You know, at events, it's extra accreditation. So there's a lot of these challenges that come with it. And then on the other side, you know, you look at, I have a little 7-year-old niece and a 4-year-old nephew. And, they've grown up with me with my disability, and they don't really see it anymore. You know, and I'm just the normal person. So I think it's, you know, from my side in sport, it was really negative, but really positive, because I had the opportunity, but not everybody has that opportunity. So for me, that was negative. It'll be interesting to see all the disabilities competing together. Because, you know, there's 13 categories just in the Paralympics alone.
It's complex.
And then there's the, you know, there's actually 14 categories, and, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how long that games will take place. But yes, you know, I think in life, you know, from South Africa here, and the acceptance of, you know, disability within the able-bodied communities and able-bodied within the disabled communities, we look at businesses, we look at, you know, co-working spaces, we look at, you know, just communities on the whole. It's become a lot more accessible, and also accepting. You know, I know for a period, businesses were struggling to get, you know, people to come forward to talk about their disabilities or to let them know that they had disabilities, because they thought that they'd get fired. So conversations have really changed, and I think that's been really, really positive over the past few years. And, you know, as a disabled person, sometimes you see a little bit more of the disability side, you know, because you're in it. And it can be quite nasty sometimes, because ultimately, you know, you've got to stand up for your rights as well. But at the same time, I think things have shifted, and I think there's a long way to go still. And hopefully, you know, it becomes, I think, a bit more inclusive. You know, there's the equity, there's the inclusivity, you know, there's, what is it, inclusivity, diversity, equity, and accessibility. So, you know, it's diverse. And I think for me, not being in sport now and seeing it happen in business and in life, and you see sport and you see similar things happening, and you just realize that everyone is on a drive to be better. Being in South Africa, we're very conscious of color and race and gender, and you know, we're just conscious, and the conscious part of it is what's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even looking back at my sort of earlier work experience, you know, my background is in architecture, and even just learning the different building codes in different countries and sort of seeing what's behind there and how we design spaces and urban spaces for people to live and work and be entertained and all the rest of it. It's quite striking that, A, you know, often you do see that things are being created just in a certain way that is not accessible, that's not considerate, because maybe it just wasn't thought about at all. And then at that point, when you look at the building regulations in many countries, at the time, at least when I studied, disability was pretty much defined as an upper able-bodied person in a wheelchair. And that was the only disability, that dimension of disability, that was really sort of considered in the code. And beyond that, it was up to the individual building owners, designers, architects, etc., to sort of make those considerations. And it is quite extreme. You think over time, yes, it has evolved a lot. I think this, especially in the UK, the Anti-Disability Discrimination Act was a huge step forward that basically defined, okay, let's be considerate and let's make sure that all of the services can be provided to people with a disability the same way as able-bodied people and all the rest of it. And I think that's a huge, huge progress. But still, we are not there on an everyday level, I guess. I mean, Anna, what's been your experience and your view on that?
Yeah, pretty much the same. So I think it's very important that every person, it does not matter which disability it have or the person does not have, has to reach a building, or has to reach in to go to the sports club and all these things. So it has to be possible to go everywhere, because I think if it's not possible to enter a house or to enter the train or the things, it won't be possible to be inside the society. I think that's one of the most important point for myself. And I think in the last years something happened, and I think we're in a good way. But all in all, there's still a lot what we have to do that everyone is possible to take part at the society and at the daily life.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, if I can ask you, you know, obviously a lot of our listeners will be very interested in your work with Laureus as well, and Laureus as the International Sport for Good Foundations. If people want to get involved in Laureus and support the great cause and the many, many local projects that Laureus run around the globe, what do you think, Natalie, is the best way for people to get involved?
I would probably just say Google Laureus, Sport for Good Foundation, or just Laureus in general, and you'll find all the information there. There's the social media handles as well. You know, get to follow it a bit on social, get to research it a bit online, different ways, different projects. You know, it's quite an amazing concept in that, you know, there are these top sports people from around the world, and then we have these projects on the ground. And, you know, the sponsors that also sponsor a lot of the projects as well. So there's many facets to it. And I think it's to find the facet that interests you, the facet that is important to you, and then, you know, find the details on the website and contact, or on social media for that matter. So, you know, it's quite open, and, you know, it's just one of those interesting projects that has brought all levels of sport together in my eyes. And in different ways, and it has evolved as well over the last few years. It's evolved from, you know, some of the projects and their programs and teaching the kids through sport, to, you know, be it surfing, disabled surfing, is one of the projects in Durban here in South Africa. So, you know, skateboarding, all these new Olympic sports are all part of the programs. And I think that's the special part, is no matter what sport you take part in, there's always something. And just for each and every person who's interested, go and Google, go and follow on social media handles, Laureus, and, you know, just follow and see if you like it, see what you like, and then make contact.
The social media marketeer and digital marketeer speaking there, definitely. And Anna, of course, there's a very strong foundation at Laureus in Germany as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's very difficult to point on one special project. So I was on a project where it's a project in kindergarten, and the kindergarten, for example, they have a partnership with where some horses are, and the people. So the it's an integrative kindergarten. Once a week, they go to deal with the horses, and it was great to see. It was great to see the fun and the happiness of the kids. And it did not matter which disability they had. And of course, there's one project where teenagers go skiing. You know, I think that's very great. So honestly, I wanted to go there and want to work with the teenagers there too. But, you know, then there was the COVID-19 thing.
Yes.
And things became more difficult.
We've done really well. We managed an hour without mentioning the word COVID. I thought that was exceptional.
Yeah. Sorry.
<incorrect. laughs> I was going to ask you, so that must have had an impact on your camp business as well in the setup phase. But, you know, we got around it for over an hour. So that's good.
So that's one of the projects I really want to visit and want to work with the teenagers. You know, there are so many projects and camps Laureus has in Germany. When I had a look on the website, I was overwhelmed about the diversity and about the number of different projects. So I can talk the next hour about the different projects, but these two projects I have seen with my own eyes, and the last project that's something where I want to do a little more in the next years.
Brilliant. Sounds fantastic. And of course, we wish you all the best and much success with all of those things you're doing there at the moment. And finally, we've got to talk a little bit about the larger topic of time. Of course, first of all, just to point out again for everyone who's not aware that we have been creating special signature Laureus watch editions ever since 2003. I think, Natalie, you pointed the date out correctly. I think that was the Portuguese chronograph, the very first Laureus watch, all the way to this year's, which is actually a Pilot Mark 18 in blue ceramic. And every time we organize a children's drawing competition globally, and the winner winner's drawing is engraved on the back. And of course, this watch really supports all of the work of the Global Laureate Sport for Good Foundations and projects as Natalie and Anna just described. So that's your chance to support in that small way. And then, of course, at the end of every one of these podcast episodes, I have a couple of time-related questions. I'm going to pick them randomly and just fire them at you. So, Natalie, I've got to ask you, what is your first ever watch memory? What is your first watch, and how and where did you get it? If you ever had
my first memory would actually be winning a watch in a race that I swam in a lagoon.
That's not bad.
Yeah, so it was pink with a black strap.
Okay.
and yeah, it was a swimming watch. So it ended up swimming all my training sessions with me and timing myself. So I guess that's my biggest memory. Obviously, I had a watch when I was younger.
Yeah. So was that a digital swimming watch, I guess, the pink and black?
Yes,
one?
Yes. So I could actually time myself. It had a timer, so
wow,
I could swim links.
It was like a competitive swimming.
Not always. In open water, it doesn't pick up. It never used to pick up very well. And, you know, in the back in the day, it was only 50 meters, what did you call it, water resistance. So, you know, you couldn't go diving with it, but it was good to swim with. And I remember, you know, on weekends, just randomly going and doing a training session on my own and timing myself. You know, it was the latest toy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Anna, your first watch memory, if you have one?
Oh, I just thought about it. I have. My first watch, it was not a digital one, and I still have my first watch. It's
good.
Somewhere in my bathroom because I could not throw it away because, you have some memories about that. It's a red one with yellow, blue, green stripes, and yes, but it was beside sports.
You like your colors in watches, I have to say.
Yeah.
We have a note to product management, make them colorful. Brilliant. And Natalie, final question. To you, if you think back your career, your life, that one moment where you just felt like stopping time forever, what would it have been?
If I tell you, it was actually qualifying for the Olympic Games. It was the most perfect race that I could have ever had. Just everything clicked from start to finish. Not beforehand and not really afterwards, but the race itself, it was like time had stopped. And it was just, I wasn't hit, I wasn't kicked, I fed perfectly. I was in the top four in the last kilometer, and I was just far enough ahead. And it was just the most perfect moment. And I think trying to recreate that so many years later, it was impossible. Obviously, different time, different circumstances, different conditions, different everything, age, etc. But it's one of those moments that I would have loved to have been able to have over, because moments I don't think you always think too much about, and only once they're over do you get to think a little bit about them.
Yes, absolutely. And that's always you wish you could go back to it and just feel it and take it all in again. Sometimes you're in an absolute daze and it's just like, where's it gone? And Anna, for you?
It's an easy question. It has to do with a race too, but it was not the race. It was my second gold at the Paralympics in Pyeongchang. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, because it was when I finished the race. So I came into the finish area, and there was a big crowd of people. So thousands of people, and it was the moment when I crossed the finish line and when I saw that I won the race. And then I had a view to the people, and there I saw my whole family was seven persons came over Korea, South Korea, and I saw them celebrating. So that was for me I think it was the best moment of my career, and I love to remember this moment.
Amazing story, very touching, and thank you both of you for coming on the podcast today. I'm sure, thank you for sharing your story, thank you for sharing your insight, and the amazing work you're doing at the moment as well. Wishing you all the best for all of your projects, your ventures, and of course with your work with Laureus as well. And I'm sure you've inspired a few listeners here to start their or change their own path indeed based on where they are today. Thanks a lot for coming, Natalie. Pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me on the podcast. It's always great to also speak with Anna and, you know, get different sports together. And I think from that perspective, you know, get completely different ideas and you know, reasons behind things as well, because we can all learn lessons. So thank you for having me. And thank you, Anna, for allowing me to be a part of this as well. And it was great to, you know, to hear your side of the story.
Yeah, and thank you, Anna, all the way to the mountains. The sun has well and truly gone down now. I can see this out of my windows.
Yes, it is. It's dark. So thank you from my side. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Natalie, too. I think after this this podcast, I know what I want to do with this in the evening. Maybe I will Google Natalie. We'll see. And really, I would look forward to... To hear you once again would be really great.
Absolutely. Well, we might see each other at some glorious event in the not too, you know, the post-COVID back to physical events. It would be great one day when we don't have to spend half of our time worrying about PCR tests and travel restrictions anymore. that'd be nice. Thank you very much. We could have talked for hours. And dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed this podcast episode, talking to two amazing athletes, their careers and their purpose and what they're doing at the moment now, using their sporting experience to transform more lives for the better. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Speak to you again soon when it's time for another one of Partners in Time. In the meantime, stay safe. Have a good one. Speak to you soon.